Chapter 37. Volk was at the helm of the submarine he and the crew called the Wasp. It had no official name, but it possessed a bulbous bow, pointed stern, and a pinched waist like the insect. Volk would have preferred they call it something more accurate, like the wallowing hippo. It was hard to maneuver, top-heavy, with the tanker mounted above it, and given to rolling badly on the surface, even in the slightest waves. Thankfully, it was far more stable when the ballast tanks were full and it was operating beneath the water. Only that made it slower than ever. After they navigated into the hull, it took hours to line up with the gap in the docking sphere. When that was done, Volk grabbed the radio. "Docking sphere, this is Volk," he said into a microphone. "Anyone awake up there?" A scratchy signal carried the response. "We're ready for you, Wasp. Cleared to surface." Volk eased the Wasp upward until it cleared the waterline. "Shutting down," he called out. "Pull us to the dock." Inside the sphere, a group of crewmen, walking on metal grates, jumped aboard the bow, tied the line off, and pulled the submersible to the dock. "Equalizing pressure," the co-pilot said. Volk felt his ears popping. "Pressure matched. Releasing the hatch." A hatch opened directly above them. The co-pilot went out first, followed by Miar. Volk went through last and found the nearest crewman. "Is the next shipment ready?" "You'll have to check with the foreman," the crewman said. "There was a problem with the new cultures." Volk glared at Miar for a moment. He suspected the problem was the scientists' doing. "Come with me." With Miar in tow, Volk walked along the metal grate, each footstep echoing off the curved steel walls around them. They made their way to the opening of a steel tube 6 feet in diameter. This was the conduit that had been welded into place between the docking sphere and the tank next to it, which they called the control sphere. "After you," Volk said. Miar disappeared into the tube, and Volk followed just a few steps behind. Kurt and Joe slipped through the gap in the bottom of the docking sphere far more easily than the bulky submarine. Looking upward, Kurt noticed the same shimmer on the sonar readout that he'd seen when looking to the surface before. There was air on the other side of that shimmering line. "They've turned this into an underwater habitat." "We should examine their work," Joe said. "I thought you'd never ask." Kurt shut off the sonar system and studied the layout, using only the visible light. The submarine with the tanker was docked above them to the left. The illumination was brightest in that area. On the other side of the sphere was another submersible, the small, disc-shaped craft they'd battled in the Gulf of Mexico. "Follow me," Kurt said. He swam beneath the disc submersible and surfaced behind it. As expected, there were no crewmen in that area. Joe surfaced moments later, and the two of them gazed across the water toward the larger submarine with the tanker on its back. Three crewmen were working on it, blasting jets of hot air into the couplings of the tanker truck, and then following that up with another gas. "What do you think they're doing?" Kurt asked. "Nitrogen," Joe said. "They're making sure there's no water or other impurities in the couplings that might contaminate what they're about to load. Assuming it's the bacteria Paul and Gamay discovered, I can't say I blame them." With a second hose connected to the tanker, the men sat down on overturned buckets and waited while the entire truck was pumped full of inert gas. "How long do you think that will take?" "Depends on the pressure level," Joe said. "Speaking of which," he looked at the screen on his arm, "we have 11 minutes down here before we're going to need to make a decompression stop. Wouldn't want to have to tread water at 60 feet with this group chasing us." Kurt nodded. 11 minutes should be plenty of time to throw a monkey wrench in their plans. "What do you suggest?" "This crew isn't exactly on high alert," Kurt said. "You go play flipper and distract them from the water. I'll sneak around behind them and put them to sleep." "And then?" "We steal their overalls and walk around like we own the place, possibly pressing a few buttons and throwing a few levers and doing whatever we can to put this place out of whack." Joe slid back into the water while Kurt took off his fins, climbed carefully onto the decking, and crept around the semi-darkened sphere to a spot behind the three crewmen who were servicing the tanker. As Kurt crouched there, waiting to attack, a large eruption of bubbles began to foam up on the surface directly in front of the crewmen. One of them stood, leaning forward for a better look. "It's coming from the Wasp." As they looked on, Joe broke the surface, propelled upward by a combination of his own strength and the full energy of the powered dive suit. He surged toward the crewman like a crocodile at the edge of a muddy river. Instead of a bite, Joe grabbed the man with both hands, yanking him forward and pulling him off the dock and into the water. The other men stood and rushed forward in shock. They never saw Kurt coming. Kurt clubbed one man in the back of the neck, and he dropped straight down onto the metal grating without anything more than a grunt of pain. The second man turned, took a punch to the gut, which doubled him over, and a knee to the face that finished him off. By the time Joe surfaced with the third man, who was coughing and spitting out water and in no mood to fight, Kurt was tying the first two men up. In a minute flat, all three were stripped of their coveralls, tied and stuffed into the passenger compartment of the strange submarine with the tanker on its hull. "How many people do you have down here?" Kurt asked. 12, one of the crewmen said. "Including the three of you?" The man nodded. "Where did Volk and Miyar go?"
"The control sphere."
Kurt found some tape and slapped it over the mouths of the captives. Additional lengths of tape were wrapped around their ankles and wrists to ensure they wouldn't slip their bonds.
"You three sit tight," Joe said.
With the men secured, Kurt and Joe took off their own helmets, stored them, and pulled the crewmen's coveralls over their dive suits. The compact rebreathers were flat enough to be hidden, especially as the lines and regulators retracted into the unit itself. And while Kurt and Joe appeared slightly hunchbacked when studied in profile, the overalls were loose-fitting enough to disguise it. Dressed appropriately, they climbed out of the submarine and made their way into the tunnel that Volk and Miyar had taken. "Brilliant idea to turn this into a habitat," Kurt said. "Spheres are naturally resistant to pressure, like an archway, only in three dimensions."
"Normally I'd agree with you," Joe said, "but they've cut a bunch of holes in them. This tunnel and the gap down below were definitely not part of the original design. From an engineering perspective, that weakens things considerably. I wouldn't want to live and work down here, and I wouldn't bet our lives on the structural integrity of this setup, especially if anything goes wrong."
Kurt laughed lightly.
"What," he asked, "could possibly go wrong?"